Welcome one and all to another day here at The Damage Report with what's left of me, John Iadarola. I'm very excited that today, actually stepping in at the last minute and being a true hero for that, Farron Cousins returns to the show. Farron, it's always good to have you here.
I'm very excited to be here.
I'm really glad to have you here too. We've got a whole mess of news to dive into. I'm gonna warn the audience though, going into this as I warned you, I'm on basically no sleep because my dog was being a big old mess last night. And so we're gonna see how this goes. But everyone, brace yourselves. We've got updates on the document scandal on Mar-a-Lago. And I have a few frustrations about that that we'll get to in just a little bit. We're gonna preview a little bit of what might become of Nancy Pelosi in the near future. We've got some drama over dirty bombs. Marco Rubio going way beyond the facts on a case to make himself and his movement look like victims. And the right has moved on from an endless 24/7 attack against John Fetterman to now just attacking his wife in place of him. And isn't that fun? So everyone, in advance of all of that and more, please hit the like button and share the stream so that people know we're live. And if you want to communicate in any way with either myself or with Farron, you can send us comments, tweets, and super chats, and we'll respond as we go. But with all that said, Farron, you ready to start the show?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. Federal prosecutors appear to believe that there's a couple more remaining avenues to learn about what was going on at Mar-a-Lago when it comes to all the stolen documents. And we're gonna break down what those might be. And then I'm gonna describe why there being more ways they can find out stuff about Trump and the documents is deeply frustrating to me. But first, here is what they're focusing on. So it's two individuals that they think they could potentially pressure to get more information about what was stolen, why it was stolen, how it was concealed, and all of that. One is a figure who I had never heard of. I have a feeling most of you will not have either. Walt Nauta, I believe it is, formerly worked in the White House under Donald Trump as a military valet and cook. And then once Donald Trump was booted out of the White House, followed him to Mar-a-Lago. Now, he is originally a native of Guam and a US Navy sailor. Apparently they grew close, and I kind of want to learn a little bit more about that, because the idea that a person who works for Trump, a regular person, would grow to like Trump, I find that fascinating. What was going on between them that he would want to follow him? But anyway, it happened, okay? Now this guy was around Trump all the time. He's the guy that when Trump would mash his Diet Coke button, Walt would come in with his Coke or whatever. And so in interviews after all of this about stuff arguably more important than the Cokes, Nauta said that he had taken boxes to Mr. Trump's residence at Mar-a-Lago. One person that had been briefed on that interview between investigators and the cook said he was clear with investigators that Mr. Trump had directed him to do that, while another said that he was less specific about who had told him to move the boxes, but that the implication was that it was Mr. Trump. And it really does seem like, depending on who you talk to, he either was super clear or he wasn't. He had a set story, or the set story might have been a bit vague, or it was set in some cases and then it sort of changed over time. Now, all of that to most people seems, I don't know, why do we care? Well, the investigators appear to believe that if there is this inconsistency, that they could argue he was working to obstruct the investigation, then that might allow them to pressure him to testify and provide more information than he either has revealed yet or might even know. And so this guy who's been around Trump for a long time, not just after the inauguration of Joe Biden, but before, could be a source for more information. Farron, what do you think at this point? You think they might be able to pressure this guy to reveal more about Trump? Would this guy even know what Trump was really intending for these documents?
It kind of seems like he does know the whole intent angle, which of course, as you pointed out, is what they're trying to show. And if they can kind of approach him and say, listen, we've got you cold on obstruction right here, right now. We could easily go after you, but we'd prefer not to. That's a long process for us, and you're not really, no offense, worth it. What we want is information about what you know about Donald Trump. Did he specifically direct you, yes or no, to take the boxes? Did he know that he wasn't allowed to take the boxes? Because those two things are what prove intent. And if you don't have intent, especially in an instance like this, you legally speaking would not actually have the crime. So the prosecutors know they've got to be able to prove that in order to move forward, if, of course, charges ever come of this. And apparently the cook is the guy. The cook might be the missing link here. And you know, you talked about the fact that you want to know more about this relationship, and I do too. But I think what also needs to be said here is that everybody in Trump's orbit, if you haven't already had to talk to investigators, if you haven't already had to hire a lawyer, just know that those days are coming. It doesn't matter what you do for Trump, none of these people get happy endings. I mean, Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, John Eastman, Michael Cohen, all of these people and so many more just said, look, I'm gonna latch on to Trump. This is gonna be great for my career. No, nobody's gotten that happy ending, not even the poor cook. You know, oh great, I'm going to Mar-a-Lago. I'm gonna be a valet and a cook down here. Oh no, now I could be looking at obstruction of justice charges. I just wanted to make some well-done steaks and bring him a Diet Coke. Yep. And now my life is potentially ruined. It's a very unfortunate situation. So anybody working at Mar-a-Lago for Trump, just know, if it hasn't happened to you yet, the chances of it happening are probably pretty strong at this point. Get out while you can.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Before your 15 minutes of infamy. Yeah. 100%. Oh, side note, by the way, Hope Hicks is apparently testifying before the January 6th commission right now, as we speak, I guess. Okay. So look, you're the one with the legal background. One of the reasons I love having you on, and everything that you said about intent sounds right and smart. I find it very frustrating though. Not what you said, but the whole thing. Why do we need this cook? He had boxes upon boxes upon boxes of documents that were filling up storage closets that were in his desk. Folders marked classified. How could there be any doubt that he intended to do this? And then, okay, let's say that he didn't intend to do it, which every statement he's made since this started makes clear that he has never once said, oh my God, what are these documents doing here? Never in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine that I would take a document, be gone from Mar-a-Lago. This is my place for rest and relaxation. So he's never even claimed that he didn't intend to take the documents, but let's say that he didn't intend to take the documents. We've been through, so everybody is focused, rightfully so, on the Mar-a-Lago raid and the documents that were found during that. But we know that that was like the third or fourth time that Trump's team and either the DOJ or the National Archives had had talks or transfers of documents. So if it was just a cook who was doing stuff that he never should have done, the first time that the National Archives reached out to him, wouldn't Trump have wanted to make sure that all the documents were sent back? And the continued efforts to maintain as many as possible through multiple rounds of document transfers would be evidence that, regardless of whatever the original intent might have been, he clearly intended to hold on to them once they were in Mar-a-Lago. How is any of this still up for debate is what I want to know.
It shouldn't be, honestly, like in the eyes of the law, the debate should have ended after the first time they said, give us back the documents, and he said no. The DOJ, it's very obvious, they didn't want to do this investigation. They didn't want any of this to even happen. All they had done for over a year now was just repeatedly say, listen, you took what doesn't belong to you, we just need it back. If you want it back, fill out the paperwork, go about it the right way, and look, we'll give it back to you. But for right now, you didn't do it. We gotta have them. Just give us the documents and it's over. And this was, like you said, four or five different times. So I would argue, if I were these prosecutors, every denial of returning the documents was intent. Because even if he didn't know, which, you know, reports do suggest he knew it was illegal to take them. I think it was Pat Cipollini warned him before he even left it was illegal. But assuming he didn't know it was illegal, the first time the National Archives reached out and said, hey, this is illegal, give them back. And he said, no, there's your intent. The second time, there's more intent, and so on and so forth, leading all the way up to, of course, the letter that Christina Bob signed swearing, oh, we gave it all back. There's so many lies. There's so much deception. There is just intent pouring out of every possible facet of this investigation. So yeah, like why do we even need the cook? Why do we have to talk about Mr. Nauta right now? He should be just, you know, a figure out there cooking or doing whatever the heck it is he does, because I think we've got intent every step of the way in this investigation, but they want an airtight case. So I guess that's what they're going for. Just get as many people as you can to prove intent, and then harder for you to lose at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes one wonder how they could possibly lose. So everyone stay tuned to find out, because you're going to find out. Okay, let's turn to the second aspect of this. DOJ investigators looking into the stolen documents at Mar-a-Lago have a second person that they think they might be able to use to tighten the case against Donald Trump. This is this individual you're probably more likely to have heard of than the first, the cook. Kash Patel, longtime aide and ally to Mr. Trump. They want to bring him in to answer questions before a grand jury about how the documents were taken to Mar-a-Lago. And how Mr. Trump, his aides, and his lawyers dealt with requests from the government to return them throughout 2021 and the beginning of 2022. So bear in mind that shortly after the initial raid, Mr. Patel publicly proclaimed that the former president had declassified the records before leaving office. So they would like him to come in and testify to that. You've said that it's the case now. Why don't you say that under oath? And I think that that's a reasonable request. I think it is really interesting that he is out there saying that they were declassified, whereas most defenders of Donald Trump have limited themselves to saying documents can be declassified, you know, maybe mentally. He actually said that it had happened. You'll note that there's a difference between that and the stance of his lawyers, who refuse to say literally anything about declassification. Again, they will not say whether he did or did not declassify them. Because, and this is, I'm gonna be delving into the dangerous territory of speculation, because he didn't declassify them, they're lying. So anyway, in theory, Kash Patel is not gonna wanna go on the record as saying they're declassified when there's literally no paper trail to that effect. So bringing him in might result in some, I don't know, some testimony that looks, that makes Trump and his lawyers look a little bit uncomfortable or awkward. I don't know. I don't know exactly what you get coming out of this, but I think part of that, as you had said earlier, Farron, trying to make it as airtight a case as possible, is they just want to get Trump or his legal team on the record lying as part of their defense. There's been this gap between the forward-facing public defense and what they've actually been willing to attest to before Raymond Deary, the special master, so far. And I think they just want to merge those two worlds. And it's gonna be really interesting to see. At some point, Trump's legal team is going to have to go on the actual record. Do you think that Kash Patel could be an important part of that?
He might be, but the weird issue with him is, if he says, if he walks in, you know, in a deposition or as part of an investigation under oath, whatever it is, and he says, yes, I personally saw Donald Trump declassify these documents. He said it, he stood over them, he declared it, you know, did whatever it is he had to do, and he did it. And they're gonna say, okay, where's the evidence? Well, the evidence is me telling you this. And that is gonna put the DOJ to say, okay, well, we think you're lying. Patel will say, but I'm not. And that's what you have. Like that is literally what is going to play itself out in court, if that again is where this goes. So the DOJ is not necessarily going to be able to prove that he is lying, because there's no paper evidence here, unless of course there is a caveat to that. I'll get to that in a moment. Or secondly, Patel is not going to be able to prove that this actually happened, because there's no physical evidence other than what he claims to have happened. Now, where they could get him is if he goes on the record and says, okay, it happened here, it happened at this time, and it happened in this way. And then if they talk to somebody else who was there, maybe it's Trump, maybe it's somebody else, and they say, oh yeah, it happened at a different place, at a different time, in a different way, then you can easily prove, okay, well, your stories don't match up. One of you is lying, probably both of you are lying. Maybe you should have talked about it beforehand, even though that's illegal. But what I'm saying is, Patel has had a lot of time with Donald Trump recently. Mm-hmm. If Patel is the only person who says, I saw Trump do this, there's a possibility the two of them could have sat down at any point in the last few months and said, okay, when did it happen? Where did it happen? What was I wearing? What was the weather like? Let's get all the little minute details worked out.
Sure.
So that way, when they come asking, we can both tell the same story. Again,
yeah,
pure, pure speculation, right? We don't know that that happened, but I'm saying there's opportunities for that to have happened. But beyond that, short of Patel producing evidence that this happened, the DOJ is not going to be able to necessarily prove that he's lying, but that's irrelevant compared to the fact that Patel can't prove that it happened. So the jury's not going to buy what Patel is selling them. And yeah. I think that's probably the biggest point.
Just, I get all of what you're saying, but just to be clear, like there would have to be paperwork for this declassification because it is not actually a psionic enterprise to declassify documents. So like them saying it happened, if there isn't the documents, it is irrelevant that they just say it, right?
It is, because that is, of course, one way to declassify documents. He can come out and say, okay, this is declassified, go do the thing. Like you have to have that second part. It has to be filed with whatever agency it's from, DHS, DOJ, CIA, you know, whoever it is. They then have to go through, mark it up, redact what needs to be redacted. There's a process. It's not just saying, hey, it's free, here you go, here's documents. Yeah. That's not how it works. So yeah, you're gonna have to have the follow up, but he can, of course, direct people to say, I am officially declassifying these things. Then comes the second part, and we never had the second part on any of this. So
sure.
That's where we kind of get into, I guess, the constitutional crisis of, but he said it, but he didn't, but yeah. They didn't do it. So is it or isn't it? And with the way the Supreme Court is, that's terrifying because they could easily, you know, interject at some point if it comes to it and say, oh, no. All the president has to do is say, yeah, it's done, and then it's done. And that's going to be terrible for this country moving forward, regardless of who is president at that point. But we could see that from them.
Yeah, and let's, you know, it's been a bit since I've seen a write-up about this, but early on there had been references to certain documents that cannot even be declassified during that process that you had talked about, that there, he does not actually have control over literally every document that the federal government controls. But this is sort of a demonstration of the difference that people point out between people like a candidate like Trump and a candidate like DeSantis. First of all, DeSantis probably never would have wanted the documents, but if he wanted the documents, he would have just done the paperwork. Why didn't he just do the paperwork? Like Trump just continually undercuts himself with his laziness and lack of attention to detail. He could have mostly declassified these and been fine. This is such an own goal. None of this scandal, we could have set this aside, never known about it, and focused on the billion other lawsuits that he's currently facing. But unfortunately, he's so wildly incompetent that he turned this into a big thing. Anyway, with that said, I think we're gonna take our first break. When we come back, we need to talk about Nancy Pelosi, what she is potentially facing come the midterms and what might come after that. We're gonna discuss after this. Okay, Farron, I think it's time for a little bit of fun. Let's dive into the future. Everybody knows the midterms are gonna be tough on the Democrats, but perhaps no one is gonna have it a little bit worse than Nancy Pelosi. She's in charge of the Democrats in the House for the second time. It's a historic thing, but that's looking like it's not gonna last. And a lot of the media coverage is starting to reflect this, trying to reflect on what is going to happen to her, who is potentially going to step into not only her shoes, but the shoes of the other incredibly elderly members of Democratic leadership in the House. You've got the New York Times talking about her last dance and her sprint across the country to raise as much money as possible. Now look, it's the New York Times, so while they kind of have to talk about what comes next, they're also pretty defensive towards her. They describe her as an 82-year-old juggernaut in Armani, behaving as if holding the House rests in her hands alone. In some ways it does. She is not only the well-established national face of the House majority, but is also by far its most prolific fundraiser, which is true, and we'll talk about that. Now, they do point out that back in 2018, she agreed to a term limit for her speakership. Now, the thing about that is when politicians say what they'll do in the future or what they won't do, they always stick to that because these are people who care about their honor. If they say they're gonna run for something or not, then you definitely could take that to the bank. No, if she could stay in charge, she's gonna stay in charge. She doesn't care. But anyway, she's raised a lot of money, they point out, bringing in $1.25 billion for Democrats over the last two decades. That is a lot of money. And to politicians like Nancy Pelosi, that is literally the only thing that matters. So anyway, she's almost certainly not gonna be in charge in just a few months, Farron. We can certainly talk about who might replace her because I imagine she's not gonna stick around for the 2 or 4 or 6 years that would be required for them to regain control of the House. But what do you think her role is going to become once she's no longer the speaker?
Money. That's it, just flat out money. Just keep raising that money. I mean, that's, we all know like that's why she's still there. And occasionally, yeah, she'll get in a good zinger against the Republicans every now and then in the media. She had a good one against Donald Trump this past weekend. But beyond that, clearly not doing a good job of trying to keep the Democrats together. I mean, she's squashing anything that could be remotely considered progressive. So I do think it's time for Pelosi to say, listen, thank you for everything. I can still raise money for you, but I don't have to be in that position. Now, I don't think she would ever voluntarily do that, but I do think the Democrats in the House need to start pushing it that way. Listen, thank you for your service. We appreciate everything you've done. It's been historic, but we've got to provide a better face for the Democratic Party than a bunch of octogenarians who are so out of touch with the public that they don't even like what they see. I mean, poll after poll shows people want term limits. They want age limits for Congress. The Republicans are getting younger. I mean, Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, she's a little bit more up there, but she's still younger than all these leadership Democrats. Lauren Boebert, I mean, hell, Madison Cawthorn was just a child, basically. I'm sorry, compared to me, I do think so. But they're trending younger with their representatives, definitely trending younger with the people they choose to serve on the federal judgeships out there. Yeah. And the Democrats need to understand we've got to look to the future, and the future is not a bunch of people pushing 90 years old. I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend anybody with that, but we need that young blood. We need the new fresh faces. And you want to talk about who could replace her? I'm gonna go ahead and cast my ballot right now for Katie Porter.
I knew you were gonna say that, and I don't hate it. Well, we're gonna talk about the next people in just a sec. I'm glad that you brought up the difference in at least the faces that we're seeing on the other side. Yes, I think you're totally right. The right is trending younger. I mean, I don't know exactly how old Matt Gaetz is. I mean, to be fair, you know,
he's quite.
Look, he's quite a bit older than the people he chooses to date, but yeah, he is younger than most Democrats in leadership. That's a great point. Now, the Democrats do have some powerhouses that are young as well, but the Democrats have no desire to have them ever hold any real power. That's sort of the difference. And look, the right can afford to just choose like random young people because they don't care if these people literally know anything, have any relevant experience, know anything about legislation. They're not out, like they can just choose. Like it's like if they were to just take me at 27, hey, he makes YouTube videos, he seems like an a-hole, let's make him the next congressman. That is literally what they're doing in choosing the Boeberts and the Marjorie Greene was just a woman who put Facebook videos up. That's it. And then all of a sudden she's their next congressperson. So yeah, there's a bit of a difference there. I want to talk a little bit about what Pelosi will be remembered for, though. I don't think it's like a coincidence that the New York Times is focusing on money. That's what everyone focuses on when it comes to her. And look, she has raised a lot of money. Money is regrettably important in politics. I don't want that to be the case, but as of right now, it is. And I'm sure that some of that money has benefited the Democrats broadly, and maybe even some progressives. But I also know that she supports certain types of candidates and doesn't support others. I'm not gonna forget what happened with Jessica Cisneros and Henry Cuellar just recently. Like, she could wield her power in a different way. And when I think about what has happened during the periods in which she has been speaker, it's not to say that there haven't been big things, even under Biden. You know, he's had some pieces of legislation recently that have been good. But the test of a leader is not what happened while you're a leader. It's what wouldn't have happened had you not been leader. And Nancy Pelosi has been there for things. She was there for the ACA. She's there for the infrastructure bill and the climate bill and all that. But does anyone think that those wouldn't have happened if it had been someone other than Nancy Pelosi? Whereas there are opportunity costs too. There are some great progressive priorities that clearly she hasn't prioritized. And so I don't know, like I think it is historic no matter what. And certainly her ability to raise money is unprecedented, but there have been costs to her holding that spot. And I think that the left has borne those costs possibly more than anyone else.
No, I agree with you on that too. And I think a lot of it, you know, when you also talk about the young people on the Democratic side, that people like Pelosi really don't want to see capture the power. A lot of what Pelosi has been doing for, I would argue, at least the last 10 years, is she's just been preserving her power. It doesn't really matter if she's speaker or if she's minority leader, she's got hers. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, she's gonna be fine either way. If she gets voted out of office, which isn't gonna happen, but if she did, she's totally fine. She's got her multiple freezers stocked full of ice cream. She's got nothing to worry about. You know, what could happen is that some of these other Democrats, like the younger generation, they're out there actually making proposals. They're out there pushing legislation. They're pushing ideas. And that is not what Pelosi has done for, again, I would say at least the last 10 years. So those people still have stakes. For them, this is still, we have to accomplish things. For Pelosi, in my opinion, a lot of it is, well, let's raise money, we'll give it to the Democrats. Well, if we don't win, we'll come back in 2 years and we'll do it again. These people are like, no, I wanna see change. I wanna make this happen. I'll go sleep on the steps of the Capitol to make my point and raise awareness. Those are the people that we need in leadership positions. But I do agree, I don't think the current leadership would let that happen. And I think the Republicans have done a good job of trashing those people so much that it has weakened their broader appeal, you know, in terms of trying to make one of them the speaker in 2, 4, 6 years. I don't know that a member of the squad would be able to do that because of the propaganda against them. That's why I always go back to Katie Porter, who's the big fighter that doesn't have that, you know, Fox News attacking her 24 hours a day baggage. That's it. It's not real baggage. It's not real baggage. Don't get me wrong. But that's why I always go back to her. But I do think Pelosi's just kind of in self-preservation mode. It doesn't really matter to her if they win or lose because she's got hers. And that's the mentality we got to get out of there.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you contrasting her with Cori Bush, I think it makes all the sense in the world. It is like, I can't even say for Nancy Pelosi that she wants change necessarily. She might be willing to have change a little bit, a level better than, and often just stands in the way of it. A politician would be better if they want change, but maybe don't prioritize it. And then you have people who need it, who fight for it. They desire change. And that is so far away from not just Nancy Pelosi, but every member of leadership. And you know, you put forward Katie Porter. When I read the names being thrown around, there's a few that I'm not even familiar with, but two, that Hakeem Jeffries and Adam Schiff. Yay, with Adam Schiff, surely we will rise to greater heights than ever the Democrat Party has known before. Who wants that? Maybe CNN wants that. I'm sure they would find that to be very exciting. Maybe some people on MSNBC. Maybe, I don't know, your uncle would like Adam Schiff in charge. But how is that the solution? We have a climate crisis bearing down on our species. I don't think that's the solution. And speaking about baggage, I wonder if Fox News will come up with a way to attack Speaker Adam Schiff. Anyway, we'll see. We'll see how, what she's gonna do. You know, she could well run again. She's 82 and she spends a lot more time traveling than I do. I'll give her the energy thing, but what she uses that energy for is more of an issue for me. I want to give you an idea of the experience that I had over the last 24 hours. I read that the Congressional Progressive Caucus put out a letter urging President Biden and the executive branch to engage in more proactive diplomacy when it comes to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, the Russian invasion. Then I read that there had been some sort of problem with that story reported by the Washington Post, and people began to take issue with it, saying, well, actually turns out that this letter was not written this week. It was written back in July. Why are you presenting it as if it was just sent? And then it turns out, no, yes, it was written in July, but it actually was just sent now. And you might think, well, okay, that's a little bit weird, but I guess it's not a problem, except it very much was a problem, because some of the people who had signed on to it say that now the specific language in the letter they would no longer support because the situation on the ground is very different. And that is already after the fact that they've now been attacked for a day, the signers of the letter, for appearing to ignore efforts that President Biden had made in that area, except that they didn't really, because when it was written, many of those things hadn't yet happened. So now leftists are being attacked for supporting diplomacy and being attacked for saying, like, they're being presented now as if they're attempting to undercut Joe Biden right before a midterm, even though many of them who might still just as much support the idea of proactive diplomacy did not choose to send the letter now. And most recently, the letter has been retracted. And so the entire thing, in virtually every way that the sending of a letter could be, is a complete and utter mess. And I think that's where we're at, Farron, when it comes to the progressive letter. I have to imagine that this could have been handled a little bit better.
You know, it's not a funny issue, but the way you describe it, obviously, it's a train wreck of something that shouldn't be a train wreck. Like, how difficult is it to send a letter to the leadership of the country and be like, hey, we don't want to see people getting killed, so is there maybe something else we could try? I don't know. Let's try talking to people, see if we can stop the killing, see if we can avert World War III. You know, we've dumped a ton of money over here. We've sold them all kinds of weapons. The weapons manufacturers have already made billions. They got theirs. Yep. Can we end this? Can we do something that is going to stop this massive loss of life? And yep, even that, they're like, I don't know what happened to the letter. Everybody dropped out, so I guess we're just not going to send it. Nothing makes sense. The only thing that makes sense is that nothing makes sense anymore. And so we're stuck in this endless cycle. And I don't know when it breaks, other than maybe if Republicans take back the House and then we end up with something far worse in the next year. So yeah, I don't know. This letter may have been the last chance and they couldn't even get that right.
Yeah, I don't. And I look, I would love to be able to tell you at least who is responsible for this, but I have no idea. That guy named Tiny in the chat is saying, clearly this is Louis DeJoy's doing. Look how badly he butchered the USPS. I don't know, Jayapal's in charge. Is it her? She, I think, according to her Twitter, still supports the content of the letter. But I'm sure all of the people who are saying that now they would want the language to be different, they clearly didn't sign off on this being sent. And so I don't know, oh, members of the squad signed onto it. Are they okay with it being said? I really have no idea at this point. And they've already been attacked over it. Like, how crazy is that? This is really has been bungled in every way that it could have been. The general point, though, that obviously there does need to be a push for diplomacy, and let's also point out, obviously there is that ongoing, is important. Now, I might look at the situation and say, I think they can push for it as much as they want. I don't think that Vladimir Putin gives a damn. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it anyway. And you know, I might say that were he to put forward what he wants, I have a feeling that his demands are going to be unacceptable to the Ukrainian people. And that at the end of the day is who it's up to. It's not up to America. It's not up to even American progressives. But that is on Putin at the end of the day. You have to at least give him that opportunity to demonstrate that he doesn't care how many Russians die and he's willing to, you know, see this through until, you know, utter horror. In the backdrop of this, by the way, while this is being so mishandled, you have this drama over claims that a dirty bomb is about to be set off. And like with virtually everything else throughout this invasion having to do with nuclear weapons, both sides are simultaneously blaming the other. And as always, a lot of it focuses around the conflict around one particular nuclear plant. So Russia says that Ukraine is about to set off a dirty bomb on their own territory, which obviously is not a thing you'd probably want to do, but they say they're going to do it because then that will allow an escalation in the war. I guess they mean more aid would be given to Ukraine because I don't know what else the Ukrainians could be doing that they're not already doing. Now, Ukraine says, well, Russia actually controls that nuclear plant. They're doing construction there. They won't let any like outside observers go to see what they're doing. So if anyone is planning to do anything suspicious with nuclear materials, it's probably the ones who have control of the materials and are being super secretive about it. But then, of course, critics of Ukraine and the US are saying, but you're only saying that because you want Ukraine to do this false flag attack. And the entire thing is obviously both impossible to be sure about and overall disgusting and seems tailor-made to make regular people just back up from the entire thing and not even pay attention. Farron, what do you think?
No, it's a complicated situation. It's a complicated situation that we don't have the solution for, but you and I aren't supposed to have the solutions to this conflict, right? That's for Washington, D.C. to come up with this. And the only way to do that, of course, is diplomatically. You know, I think we're past the era of human development where you can just bomb somebody into submission and then you take control and everything is yours. We've evolved. I would like to think we've evolved, but that is for our leaders to work on. And if they're not gonna take that approach, if they won't even consider a letter, if we can't even get our leaders to think about a letter asking for a diplomatic solution, then we are stuck in this cycle. And I think what we've seen from Russia is that Putin doesn't care. Every person in that country that is not Vladimir Putin himself is cannon fodder. And by God, he will send every person, doesn't matter if they're older than Nancy Pelosi or if they're 10 years old, hey, guess what? We're out of soldiers, you're up now. So he's gonna fight until the last man because he's at the point where if he doesn't, he looks weak. And he absolutely, he's like a Donald Trump character in that regard. He can't have that happen. So we're gonna see more of the oligarchs in Russia that speak out against Putin and then fall out of windows. I mean, that's literally happening. And he won't stop. He won't stop until the people of Russia make him stop. And I don't know what the overall solution is, but that's where we're at.
No, it's that this is why you do not want people who don't give a damn about their own people to run countries, because the incentives are all wrong. He's worried about the perception of his strength rather than the lives of literally thousands of Russians who are gonna be slaughtered over the course of the next couple of months. And that's not good. If you really cared about your people, you could just go. That's why I hate, even in the letter, they keep saying that Putin has no way out. As I keep saying, the way out is to the east. Get out. You invaded, you can uninvade. You can turn the tanks around, assuming they're still operational, and you can go. That seems reasonable to me. And if you want to protect the Russian people, spend less time attacking Ukraine, spend more time propping up the buildings that make, it's the slope that makes people so likely to fall out the windows accidentally. You just need to prop it back up. And that way people won't trip constantly and fall out of windows.
A couple of wet floor signs might help too.
Exactly, yeah. It's weirdly slippery near windows in Russia. I don't know why that is. It's the humidity, I suppose. Anyway, with that said, we're gonna take another break. And when we come back, hey, is some right-wingers actually being called on their BS and facing legal consequences? Novel. We'll talk about it after this. Okay, everybody, let's jump into a little bit of a legal update for you. It being 2022, you might not recall two right-wing activists, I would say operatives, Jacob Wall, Jack Berkman. But back just a couple of years ago, they were almost constantly in the news for one or another ridiculous stunt attempting to take down people like Robert Mueller or Nancy Pelosi or whoever, usually alleging that they had been sleeping with dominatrices or strippers or something. Well, they're back in the news, and for something they got up to back in 2020. It was an election robocall scheme, and they've now pleaded guilty in a Cleveland court to a single felony count of telecommunications fraud over this scheme. You can see these operatives here. I'd forgotten about them, really. Anyway, what they did was, according to prosecutors, they targeted thousands of minority voters with pre-recorded messages that falsely claimed that they could face mandatory vaccination or be tracked by law enforcement if they voted by mail. They've been accused of trying to dissuade literally 85,000 voters in urban areas across the country through robocalls that included this sort of misinformation, literally in many different states. And that is seemingly, you have to do all of that for it to qualify as illegal and for there to be consequences. Just doing regular robocalls, I guess, is fine. Lots of politicians do it. It really needs to end. But they have actually now pleaded guilty, and that is great. They're facing other investigations as well, some of them having to do with those robocalls, Farron. But this is an interesting little throwback to pre-pandemic days.
I know. When I saw this headline, you know, late yesterday, I was like, oh my God, I remember those guys, the little fun press conferences they'd have out in their driveways, the big buff like Navy SEAL dude they brought out that, yeah, he's sleeping with Elizabeth Warren. And everybody was like, good for her. But you know,
get it.
What gets me is just the audacity of these kind of schemes that we see from Berkman and Wall. They knew, I mean, they had to have known at least what they're doing is illegal, but they did it anyway. And now here we are 2 years later, they're just now pleading guilty. They're each probably looking at, I think, a maximum of what, 1 year in prison. That's it. I mean, there's no telling the kind of damage that they did in the 2020 election. We don't know if people were in fact intimidated and did stay home. Like you pointed out, tens of thousands of people received these calls. So this is a very minimal punishment, I think, for what these two individuals did. But the fact they did it in the first place, just blatantly lying, making up the weirdest conspiracies ever in this robocall, and they thought they'd get away with it. I don't know. I can't understand that at all.
Like, have they ever caught anyone for putting up, you know, this happens every single election, posters saying, due to unprecedented interest in the election, Republicans are going to be voting on Tuesday, Democrats are going to be voting on Wednesday. Those go up literally every election. I've never seen anyone go to jail for it. I think it was a good gamble for them to think that they would get away with it. I'm a little bit torn on the potential sentence. As you say, considering the damage done, a year does seem short. But I also think I would not want to spend 23 minutes in prison. And so a year, that seems pretty bad. I'm always torn in that particular area. It does seem weird that of all of the things they did, all of the attempts to defame public figures, that this is the one that they're getting caught on. That seems so weird. Apparently they're just gonna get away with having that guy standing with an AirPod in his ear, so he looked like Secret Service. He was literally just a guy with an AirPod. What a weird thing. And also, can I just say something that's gonna make me seem super naive or, I don't know, childish? It would never occur to me, and I would never do, putting together a robocall that you know is a lie and sending it out to lie to voters. It is so against literally every instinct I have politically. Like, imagine knowingly lying to people about stuff this consequential. I understand I shouldn't be new to the concept of crime. I know that people kill each other and stuff, but I don't get it. Just hold positions that are reasonable and persuade people towards them. Isn't that how this is supposed to work? I can't conceive of actively lying to people like that.
You know what? Anyway. I will trade. I would be willing to trade, let these guys get off the hook scot-free for their robocalls. Mm-hmm. If the federal government could instead track down the extended warranty people and throw them all in prison forever. I would trade the extended warranty people for Wall and Berkman. They can walk free. Put those, because I actually, when I purchased my car, as the first new car I ever got a year ago, I did buy an extended warranty. And by God, I still get the damn phone calls. Like, no, I've got one. I don't know what you want from me. But if it turns, you know what? If it turns out Wall and Berkman are behind those robocalls too, look, I'm just throwing it out there. I'm just asking questions.
You should have a press conference about it, I think. Anyway. Okay, well, let's end our hour with one more conversation. This is an unfortunate one, but we're going to engage with it. Yesterday, Marco Rubio let the country know about an apparent shocking attack against a canvasser for his campaign, tweeting last night, "One of our canvassers wearing my t-shirt and a DeSantis hat was brutally attacked by four animals who told him Republicans weren't allowed in their neighborhood. He suffered internal bleeding, a broken jaw, and will need facial reconstructive surgery." Now, this individual, who has since been identified as Christopher Monzon, a former city council candidate in Florida, was attacked. That is true. And any sort of attack like this, whether it's to a canvasser or literally a random person, is completely unacceptable. Besides that, he got a couple things wrong, and suspiciously wrong in a way that makes him and conservatives look like victims. Now, some of what he said could turn out to be true. There's just no evidence yet that it is true. So police reports state that a man confronted an unidentified victim, Monzon, while he was canvassing. That's true. The report says the man told him he couldn't walk through his neighborhood. They got into a verbal confrontation, then the man knocked him to the ground and began hitting him. There is no claim in the police report that anything political was said, that anyone said Republicans can't be here or anything like that. And in fact, a third party came in and kicked the alleged assailant in the face. So rather than it being four people apparently jumping one poor Republican, it seems like there was a fight where multiple people were being hit. And there was at least three sides to this attack. Now, none of that was reflected in what Rubio had to say. They also point out, by the way, people who know this area, which I don't know, maybe you know Florida, Farron, that is a very Republican area. So it seems weird to present it as like a liberal bastion targeting Republicans who dare to step foot in them. Now, again, the guy was actually attacked, and that is unacceptable. Even unacceptable when you find out that he apparently is a guy with a really bad political past. He's refers to himself as the Cuban Confederate. He's was a member of the White Supremacist League of the South. He apparently went to the Unite the Right rally. He attacked people with a Confederate flag at a protest in Hollywood, Florida back in 2017. He was literally the only counter protester at this event. And he really pioneered using these flags as weapons to try to kill people. Now that said, you still can't beat him in the streets. That's unacceptable. But what Marco Rubio did with this instance, I think incident is also unacceptable, trying to present it as a politically motivated like hit job. But Farron, what do you think?
Well, I think everything you just said is the problem. Not the way you said it, not the fact that you're laying out facts, but you had to explain all of that in 2 minutes.
Sure.
Marco Rubio was able to explain it in one tweet. A Republican got beat up by Democrats. That's all that matters, because it's all about that short little messaging. You don't need the context. You don't need any real facts. He was wearing a Rubio shirt in the hospital bed with his face black and blue and blood coming out of him. That's the image that these conservatives care about. That's all that mattered. And that is what is so unfortunate about society today, is that if you can't say it in a short tweet, if you go 240 words, you're screwed. You got to go back to the 120 words. That's the message. If you can't do that, you've lost the narrative. And that's what sucks about today.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, maybe it turns out that it was politically motivated, or maybe it doesn't. But either way, you're going to be hearing about this. People are going to be tweeting this at you for the next 5 years. So just get used to that. Anyway, lots more to come in the aftermath. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.